Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, the Super Bowl champion of government subsidies, why the NFL itself gets away with having tax-exempt status, an appreciation of anyone other than pro football players who has to work outside in the bitter cold. We will invite calls later from vendors, construction workers, or anyone else to tell us how you survive. Plus, your high-tech detox today, your digital detox. Manu Samaroni from our New Tech City blog and podcast joins us to hear your stories of withdrawal from your devices. But first, my favorite moment from the State of the Union address and yours, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Call us up right now if you watched or listened or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, and we'll hear about the State of the Union according to journalist and former presidential speechwriter James Fallows from The Atlantic magazine. He's traveling the country right now reporting a series called American Futures, Reinvention and Resilience Across the Nation. Hey, Jim Fallows, welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, thanks. It's nice to be here with you in the studio.
And you're in the studio because you were in New York last night to host a State of the Union watching party. And sometimes you get big names at those things. So what was that like? And did you learn anything from your room about how this speech was going over?
Yes. For almost a decade now, The Atlantic, where I work, has run State of the Union viewing parties in New York, where we have a non-D.C. crowd of financiers and media people and all the rest weighing in. And I thought the reception to the president's speech last night was more positive than I would have guessed before the speech began from a mixed bipartisan crowd. There were some real Republicans there and a number of New York Democrats, but I thought they felt as if the president more or less exceeded their expectations.
I thought it was a very strong speech for one reason, that he was very upbeat, and I think he was very in tune with the moment in America at which people are very pessimistic and very disillusioned about government, whether they're progressives who think that he's not doing enough or people who would have liked to like Obamacare but who think the rollout has been a disaster, or just, you know, disillusioned Republicans and Tea Partiers. And I thought right at the beginning he turned this around on Congress in an interesting way with this one short line that was both positive and set the upbeat tone, but also told Congress, you're the do-nothing Congress. It's everybody out there that's making America great. Listen.
Tonight, this chamber speaks with one voice to the people we represent. It is you, our citizens, who make the state of our union strong.
So did you react to that, and did the room react to that? Instead of the traditional, the state of our union is strong, it is you, the viewers, the people of the country, who make our state of the union strong, and by implication, not the Congress.
Yes, I agree. And I thought that was a very important part, both of the intellectual content of the speech, to the extent state of the unions can be said to have such a thing, and the bearing of the speech, which always matters, and I think mattered exceptionally last night. The content of the speech, usually these are big laundry lists, and the content actually had a unifying theme, which was things are getting better. Let's not get in the way. Let's not screw it up. Here's how we in government can help things go in the right direction. And the president's bearing was like that, too. He seemed confident. He seemed upbeat, not embattled, not looking towards sort of the declining horizon of the rest of his time as office. And the thing I kept writing in my notepad while listening to him was Ronald Reagan. The same sense of just being optimistic about the country because of the way the country is, and sort of amused by rather than hostile at his critics and enemies.
Absolutely. In fact, remember when he was running for office and he was in the Democratic primaries and some of the Democrats took a shot at him, willfully misinterpreting, I think, a line that he had said, which is that he wanted to be a transformational president like Ronald Reagan. And he wasn't saying he wanted to pursue the policies of Ronald Reagan. He was saying he wanted to be transformational about the national mood, about how we see ourselves, which had a lot to do with optimism after a tough time in the late 1970s, the whole 1970s. And so we saw a little bit of that Reaganism on display last night.
Yes. And if you think that objectively, the first three years of his time in office were really difficult times for America with the economic collapse and just all horizons coming in all directions, still in the middle of these wars. And for him to be able to say, both in words and probably as important in his bearing, actually things are improving now. We know there are all these problems, and we know the government shouldn't make them any worse, can find ways to make them better, but the country is moving ahead, and let's recognize that.
Listeners, call us up. Your reactions to the State of the Union address last night. And did you have a favorite line? Did you have a most interesting line? We're going to get to mine right now, and we'll ask James his. 212-433-WNYC, and anything you want to ask James Fallows, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on the Brian Lehrer Show. Now, this was the most interesting thing to me. Maybe it's not the most important thing. It certainly doesn't have anything to do with what Congress might actually pass a bill pertaining to, but that's also why it was particularly interesting to me. It was when the president appealed not just to Congress to increase the minimum wage, but to private employers. Here is 1 minute of the president from last night.
Nick Shute is here today with his boss, John Serrano. John's an owner of Punch Pizza in Minneapolis, and Nick helps make the dough. Only now he makes more of it. John just gave his employees a raise to $10 an hour, and that's a decision that has eased their financial stress and boosted their morale. Tonight I ask more of America's business leaders to follow John's lead. Do what you can to raise your employees' wages. It's good for the economy. It's good for America. To every mayor, governor, state legislator in America, I say, you don't have to wait for Congress to act. Americans will support you if you take this on.
President Obama from the State of the Union, James Fallows in our studio. And I thought that was fascinating. And it was pure bully pulpit because he's got no authority over private employers and he's got no authority over state legislators or local officials. But there he was.
Exactly. And I thought it was, you know, all of the sort of preview of the speech was the president can't get legislation through, so it's going to be executive action. This will be bitter and divisive, et cetera, et cetera. And he did announce some of those. But instead he was, as you say, using the bully pulpit to say, give America a raise. This is the way, this is the free enterprise tradition. This is Americans viewing themselves as citizens in a community. So business leaders do this. I thought that was very effective.
And the other main thing that I want to talk to you about, we'll also get to your project and how the president seemed to set you up last night with some of his lines. But you mentioned the executive actions. And for all the hype that we heard before the speech about how he was going to, you know, lay down the gauntlet and tell Congress, if you won't pass bills on these important things, I'm going to do things unilaterally to the extent that the Constitution allows the president to do that. I didn't hear very many of those.
Right. There was the minimum wage, $10.10, which he said he would use for federal contractors. There was a vague statement that he would use his power in environmental issues. And he was very clear in saying climate change is real. We're going to be our children's children will look back on us. But he was not specific, I think, because he didn't want to get into the Keystone XL pipeline, which way he was going to do on that. So the minimum wage, right, was the main thing he said. The other assertion was, if you send me this Iran sanctions bill, I will veto it. And that was a very clear line.
Right. And I thought it was interesting, and I don't want to spend too much time on foreign policy in this conversation, but it was interesting to me that though he just mentioned a few foreign policy items briefly and didn't spend a large percentage of the speech on it, he came back in three separate moments to the fact that he was ending the war in Afghanistan, such a central part of why he ran for office in the first place, or at least the presidency. At the time that he did when Bush was in office. Also, he did linger on that Iran temporary deal. And I thought there he really was trying to influence Congress not to pass that, you know, he would say that stupid bill to impose sanctions right in the middle of the 6-month test, which blows the whole thing.
Yes, I thought, and I personally agree with the president on this issue. I think this sanctions bill would be very destructive, and I hope it doesn't get passed. I thought it was significant he made the positive case about Iran, not simply about the threat from Iran, which we all know about, but also the rewards of being able to bring Iran in after this 35-year estrangement, which would be like Nixon with China on a smaller scale.
the axis of potential.
Yes.
but on the executive actions, here's one that was intriguing to me because he hinted at it, but he certainly didn't announce anything, and it has to do with guns.
Citizenship means standing up for the lives that gun violence steals from us each day. I've seen the courage of parents, students, pastors, police officers all over this country who say, we are not afraid. And I intend to keep trying, with or without Congress, to help stop more tragedies from visiting innocent Americans in our movie theaters and our shopping malls or schools like Sandy Hook.
I intend to try, with or without Congress, to try and stop more shootings like this, Sandy Hook and shopping malls. Do you have any idea what he had in mind there?
I don't know the details, but I know that sort of rhetorically and politically, this was the coda to his speech 1 year ago, whose last 6 minutes were this rousing appeal, they deserve a vote. That was after the Newtown massacre. He was talking about the children there, about all the other victims of killings.
In fact, you know, you brought that up, and I pulled that clip to play next. By way of contrast, and this exemplifies, unfortunately, for him and maybe for the country, how little from last year's State of the Union address actually got enacted by Congress. And at a moment when he had just been elected, the Republican Party kind of had its tail between its legs, or so we thought, and this was one of the things that he thought was going to produce congressional action from last year's speech.
Gabby Giffords deserves a vote. The families of Newtown deserve a vote. The families of Aurora deserve a vote. The families of Oak Creek and Tucson and Blacksburg and the countless other communities ripped open by gun violence, they deserve a simple vote.
And sadly, think of all the communities we can add to that list from the last year. But they never did get their vote, or if they did in some way, it was a vote that ended in a defeat.
Yes, and there were three things a year ago in the State of the Union the president said he was going to get through Congress. That was one, climate change was another, and immigration. The minimum wage was the third. And of course, on all three of those, he has been stymied, and so he is showing that he still is committed to those issues and will be inventive with his tools other than congressional legislation. Although immigration, there was the inkling that something might actually be possible there.
And he only glanced on that, just touched it with a line or so. And maybe that was because the Republicans are meeting. They may actually do something of their own. And then there would be, you know, the usual order of things from when Congress actually used to pass bills where the Democrats would have a version, the Republicans would have a version, or the House and the Senate would have a version in this case, and then they would negotiate a final deal. So I don't think he wanted to be seen as bashing them too much.
Yes, and I think all along the idea from the Republicans has been they didn't want the president to too visibly push this issue because it's better for them within their own caucuses if it doesn't look like the president is entirely behind it. Interestingly, too, all the Republicans cheered when he gave this line about let's do something about immigration, even Eric Cantor, even Speaker Boehner. So that was a moment of more bipartisan promise than most in the speech.
And tell me if you think this was an implication of executive orders to come on the question of climate change and carbon.
Because a changing climate is already harming Western communities struggling with drought and coastal cities dealing with floods. That's why I directed my administration to work with states, utilities, and others to set new standards on the amount of carbon pollution our power plants are allowed to dump into the air.
Work with states and utilities and others. So at least going around Congress there, I don't know if it's an executive order per se.
Yes, the EPA has tremendous sway in this field. And there's the positive force of the Department of Energy and other grants. The EPA has tremendous regulatory or negative force, if you will, that's already been exerted to some extent. I expect we'll see more of that.
And one of the major things that the Obama administration will be remembered for, I think, is having the EPA declare carbon a pollutant. And there was such pushback on that politically because is carbon a pollutant? Well, it's not particulates that get into the air and get into your lungs the traditional way we think of what a pollutant is. It's this thing that's going up into the atmosphere and may cause climate change in the long run. Is that a pollutant? Under the law, under the Clean Air Act, which was passed back in the 1970s when they weren't thinking about climate change and carbon, and the Supreme Court upheld it and said it was. So if that turns out to be the vehicle by which the climate emissions, climate-relevant emissions are regulated, that's going to turn out to be a big, big thing.
Yes. And the president was talking as if he recognized the speech might be read 20 years from now, 50 years from now on the subject, saying the debate is settled, climate change is real, and we want our children's children to be able to look at us and ask, you know, if they ask us, did you do what you should, we want to be able to say that we did.
But still, it isn't a whole lot of executive actions. Oh, there was one more that we should mention, and that's a government-backed private retirement savings plan. And I was glad he mentioned that. I think one of the big problems in the country right now is the loss of traditional pensions and the fact that the 401k system, or for so many companies that don't even have that, it's just not keeping up with what people are going to need when they retire. So there is some policy yet to come if we're going to solve retirement for the future.
Indeed. And in a dozen other ways the president touched on, too, we have the modern phenomenon of business around the world, which is polarizing incomes every place. And so the pensions that used to buffer that, the union agreements and all the rest, they don't exist anymore. And so the president was suggesting a variety of ways to somewhat ameliorate that effect.
Jim Fallows, my guest on WNYC, journalist for The Atlantic, former presidential speechwriter, chief speechwriter at one time for President Jimmy Carter, with The Atlantic magazine. He's traveling the country right now reporting a series called American Futures, Reinvention and Resilience Across the Nation. And we'll play a clip from the State of the Union in just a minute, which seemed to relate very closely to the series, and we'll talk about it. But let's hear from some of you. What did you think was important in the State of the Union address last night? How did you think he did, if you want to be a pundit yourself? And what was your favorite line, if you had one, or least favorite line? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Yvette in Harlem. You're on WNYC. Hi, Yvette.
How you doing? Okay. I was at a State of the Union watch party last night, and we just really enjoyed the speech. We had a great time. And there were a lot of surprises, but the big one, big surprise for me was when he mentioned Speaker Boehner as being the son of a barkeep. I thought it was just such a great moment, and he sort of turned around and looked at him, and we just hooped and hollered, you know. And I said, oh, my God, President Obama is reaching across the aisle to acknowledge the stories, you know, of the Republicans in that one gesture, you know, that we all have stories. We all come from, you know, maybe a working class background, that we all have had our American journey. And I just thought it was brilliant. And I think it surprised Speaker Boehner.
I think you're right. I think he hesitated for a moment, like, oh, my God, what do I do with this? And then he gave that thumbs up, which, of course, makes for such a great shot that the Democrats, if they want, could use in the election year, because you have Obama smiling, Biden sitting next to Boehner in the shot, grinning from ear to ear, and Boehner giving the visible thumbs up. Jim Fallows, what did you think of that moment?
I had also marked that, as Yvette did, as my favorite line from the speech. It was nicely constructed, because Obama began by saying the daughter of a factory worker is now leading a General Motors, and so he showed her up in the box with the first lady. Then he said, the official text I have here says the son of a barkeeper is Speaker of the House. But what he actually said was the son of a barkeep is Speaker of the House, which was much more colloquial and charming. And I just thought it was a wonderful moment. Then he went on to say, and the son of a single mother can be the president of the greatest nation on earth, which was a way to bring all the different political and cultural and generational strands together with a story he's often told about himself.
Was that your favorite? Was that the one you were going to shout out?
Yes, I was going to have the son of a barkeep.
Della in Manhattan, you're on WNYC.
Yeah.
Hi, Della.
Yes, that was my favorite line, too, where this is the only country where the son of a single mom can become a president of the United States. And it also was a segue into the insistence that women earn equal pay to men because of the fact that he was a single son of a single mom. Anyway, but what I found deceptive about his speech was towards the end, where he said that we have freed nations from tyranny and fear, but we have also imposed restrictions on nations. We have imposed and we have exploited the labor of countries when we impose trade agreements on them that exploit the labor of their people. When we negotiate trade agreements with places like Bangladesh, where hundreds of people died in a factory because there are no regulations, no child labor laws. This I found deceptive because it was a segue into possibly discussing the fact that we have to make
I understand. Adele, I'm going to leave it there, but I certainly get your critique of trade policy, and I think he just glanced on it and or at it and had one kind of generally positive reference to free trade.
And you know, this was a long speech as it was, an hour plus. If State of the Union speeches covered everything a president might cover, they'd be 20 hours long. So there's always something where you can say at the end of the speech, you know, long as it was, he should have said more about X.
What do you think about the length? I remember the Clinton years when he used to give these long, long stem winders and the media would pounce on him and say, oh, he's this windbag. He goes on and on. He's full of himself. He's a bloviator. And then we'd look at the ratings the next morning and people watch till the very end.
Exactly. I think Clinton did change the modern sort of anthropology of State of the Union speeches, especially in the mid-90s when, as you say, the mainstream view, press view was this guy, won't he ever shut up? And then the ratings went up, including with these very detailed small ball proposals that Clinton was discussing. So I think since then, especially, there's been a bias in favor of detail from a president. You can go too far with that, but I think that presidents view that this is their best case to make their unfiltered – their best opportunity to make their unfiltered case to the public.
Clinton's longest speech, we just looked it up, was 63 minutes. I think the president was right about in that
ballpark last night, surprised
if not
that,
longer.
I bet we can check the longest speech record. I bet Clinton went longer than that at some point. But
it's something that my producer's checking it. But
it's on the web. It must be true.
63 minutes. Yeah, right. My impression is it would have been longer than that, too. But who knows? Michael in Manhattan, you had a favorite line?
Yes. My favorite line was President Obama's reassertion of his determination to close Guantanamo.
Yes, and he was very specific and said this year. Was that just rhetoric, or does he have a plan to close Gitmo this year?
He has a plan, but for this plan to be enacted, the Senate or the Congress has to approve trying some of these people on U.S. soil. And so if Obama were here or any of his administration people, they'd say he made an explicit promise to close it in his first State of the Union address. He did not, and the reason was the Congress blocked laws to allow people to try it on U.S. soil. So I think he was making the case, it's time to do this. That was his phrasing, it's time.
As a presidential speechwriter, did you ever write a State of the Union address?
Yes.
What year?
In 79 and 80 for Jimmy Carter.
Carter's last suit.
In 78 and 79. Yes.
So those were very difficult years.
Yes. And Carter is, as some listeners may be old enough to recall, was not a great not a great formal orator. He's quite an eloquent, extemporaneous speaker, but not from a script. And so it was a hard time for America, hard time for speechwriters, hard times everywhere.
Oh, and we have more research now from the web where everything is true. Clinton actually went 84 minutes.
Okay, that sounds more like it.
In 1995. And according to the interwebs, the two speeches that you wrote for Jimmy Carter were both 32 minutes.
Yes. Those were the days.
So did you, in your experience, see, or do you think it's happened since, that it actually does anything to move an oppositional Congress from no to yes on anything or to move the needle of public opinion? Is there any history of that? Or is it just a piece of theater every year that winds up in conversations like this the next morning and then whatever?
Both those things are true. I mean, it's true that things wash away and we'll be talking about something else 2 days from now. It'll be the Super Bowl this weekend, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, these speeches have importance. Number one, it was in a State of the Union address that President George W. Bush gave us the axis of evil and said that Iran, Iraq, and North Korea, you know, that became a sort of shaping a policy measure. The bearing of presidents matters. During some of his times, President Clinton was looking bereft, but he gave a strong State of the Union speech. I think President Obama, if he had seemed like his first debate performance against Mitt Romney last night, people would be saying he's beaten by the office, he's serving out his time, but he seemed the opposite, I thought.
Good point. I totally agree with that analysis. And listeners, keep posting your favorite lines and how you think the president did last night to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. James Fallows from The Atlantic with us. And you're doing a series now called American Futures, reinvention, and resilience across the nation. And this is not about new policy ideas, really. This is about new ways people are doing business, right?
It is. And so it's a version of the classic American road trip by air. For a long time, I've been a small plane pilot, and every little place in the U.S. has an airport. There's 5,000 small airports. And so we're going to smaller cities that have faced some kind of challenge, economic or the technology shifts of the last generation, and the ways in which they are responding. We've been to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, which is actually fairly large, Holland, Michigan, very small, Eastport, Maine, microscopic, Greenville, South Carolina last week, Redlands, California, Burlington, Vermont. And in each case, the most interesting things, I think, are these two. One is the tone has been very much like what the president described in the beginning of his speech. Every place you see people with new companies, new inventions, and just trying to do things. The other striking thing is a city as left-wing as Burlington, Vermont, or as right-wing as Greenville, South Carolina. If you didn't know their politics going in, you'd not be able to tell it by looking at them. They're all just working together.
So I found your Greenville article fascinating. It was partly about a business called the Iron Yard, an example, you say, of how almost everything new in Greenville, South Carolina reflects the fruits of a public-private partnership. And this, as you say, in one of the most conservative places in America, what's the public sector's role?
And the public sector there seemed, which is in the person of the mayor, a very strong mayor named Max White, and the city government and the county government, they say, if this is going to be a viable community in the long run, we need to redevelop our downtown, have it be a place people want to be. We have to improve our schools. They have in South Carolina, not known for its educational rankings. Within Greenville, there's a very impressive place called the Governor's School for the Arts and Humanities, where they have, you know, a sort of Juilliard aspirant training. The other is a school that my wife wrote about. It's called the Elementary School for Engineering, where they take these largely poor, largely minority kids in elementary school.
Elementary school.
They teach them how to learn about engineering, not just in strict vocational training, but saying this is part of your brain that you want to be equipped for modern life. And it just was exciting to see these things in South Carolina.
So in that context, here's one more clip from the State of the Union. And then you tell me how you think this might be going over in places like Greenville and other private sector innovation hubs.
We also have the chance right now to beat other countries in the race for the next wave of high-tech manufacturing jobs. And my administration's launched two hubs for high-tech manufacturing in Raleigh, North Carolina, and Youngstown, Ohio, where we've connected businesses to research universities that can help America lead the world in advanced technologies. Tonight, I'm announcing we'll launch six more this year. Bipartisan bills in both houses could double the number of these hubs and the jobs they create. So get those bills to my desk. Put more Americans back to work.
So, James Fallows, my question is really twofold. Are Republicans in Congress resisting efforts like that as government trying to direct the private economy too much, which sometimes it can be very bad at? And do the towns and cities with these startups that you're profiling benefit from it?
To start with the second, it's been striking in these resilient places we've seen. It's always some combination. It's often some person who just happened to be born in that town and thinks it's his or her duty to have it rebound. But then a cross-interest effort of the city government and the universities and local private companies and local startup companies. So the things which you could either call state guidance if you were thinking, oh, this is socialist, this is Obama running the economy, or you could call this public-private partnership. So the kind of things the president is talking about on the local level has been generally quite successful. I think the Republicans during Obama's time have defined their success in thwarting him. So what he is for, they are against. But just on the merits of it, this is the kind of thing they many of them are embracing in their own towns.
And you describe an e-commerce website called ShopLocket as a service for the maker revolution, the small startups all around the U.S. and elsewhere that are producing new things. And I notice you put the word things in italics. Why emphasize new things?
Because I think it's been fascinating in the past couple of years to see a style among young, innovative people to make tangible objects as opposed to just making websites or just having some new financial derivative. But they're going to produce a thing. And I think there's
some
excitement about that.
So not Uber?
Well, Uber is fine. I like Uber. But in addition to Uber, there are now people who have what you could think of as a Wright Brothers era pride in tangible manufacturing.
And be careful where you say you like Uber. It can get you into trouble.
Oh, yes, that's true.
but let's take one more caller. Abraham in West Orange is going to get pretty much our last word on what people liked from the State of the Union last night or most important moment. Hi, Abraham.
Hello there.
What moment do
you
want to hear you fine. What moment do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about the moment where the president points to the servicemen in the grandstand and it takes pride in pointing. I have never been moved by a president's speech like since I heard Franklin Roosevelt. The cadence, the rhetoric were beautiful. And to me, as a student of these things, I was excited. And to see this poor serviceman who's really been taken apart and sewn back together being applauded, I thought was the most magnificent part of this entire speech.
Abraham, thank you so much. And I don't think, James Fallows, that I've ever seen an ovation as long as the one that that serviceman got. Of course, we know State of the Union addresses are interrupted umpteen times by applause. I don't think I've ever seen a round of applause go on for as long.
That is true. And I have an answer which may be a little different from what you expect here, which is that for that young first sergeant, you know, we can only – there's no limit to the admiration for what he has done, what he has been through, his 10th deployment. For the drama of that moment, of course, it was tremendously dramatic. And I am sure that President Obama, like President Bush before him and anybody who sent people into combat, I'm sure that was a genuine tribute from President Obama. I am not sure it's a good thing about our country that we have when 99.9% of us are not directly involved in these wars, to have these moments of applauding and honoring the people who are sacrificing and then just moving on. There's a book, I think it was called Billy Lynn's Long Walk Home or Long Halftime Walk, came out a year or so ago, which was about just this sort of thing. So I thought it was our admiration is enormous for this soldier, but I think it's not really a good moment about America.
Would it be reading too much into it to say that this was once a cheerleading moment, a patriotic moment, a political manipulation so that it would end on a very sentimental note and people would go away feeling good about the president, but also a little bit of an anti-war statement because the president has that sentiment and this guy was so messed up?
Yes, and the president, he could say that this is a reason he is reducing – he has withdrawn the U.S. from Iraq, he is reducing the presence in Afghanistan, and he has leaned against being involved in other conflicts. So it's different for him to do that from President Bush before him.
James Fallows, journalist, former speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter with The Atlantic magazine, traveling the country right now, reporting a series called American Futures, Reinvention and Resilience Across the Nation. We're so fortunate to have you in New York on this day after the State of the Union address. We know you generally live in Washington and have been traveling around right now to everywhere. Where's your next stop?
We're going to heading back south again to Alabama.
All right, where hopefully the snow will stop by the time you get there. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the Super Bowl champion of government subsidies, why the NFL itself gets away with having tax-exempt status. Stay tuned.